Hello and welcome to the Icecast. My name is Shane Chebsey. This week's Icecast is a special New Year's Icecast, as in it's a recording of a previous episode of our live show that I wanted to bring to you guys just to say thank you for sticking with us. Thank you for listening to the Icecast. The recording is of our interview with Fabian Nicieza, who is most famous for the co-creation of Deadpool and also for his sterling work on X-Men titles in the 90s. And he is returning to the X-Men with X-Men Legends, which will by now be available. So I just wanted to do that as a little introduction and to say Happy New Year. And so here is the latest Icecast. There we go. And welcome to the Icecast Live. Good evening, Ollie. How you doing, mate?
I'm very good, thank you. But I've had a week off, so I'm feeling really good. How about yourself, Jay?
Definitely haven't had a week off. It's been a really busy week for me in my other life. But, you know, I like to keep busy, so that's good.
Yeah.
I loving your hat, by the way. It's very apt, isn't
Thank
it?
Thank you. I dug it out, especially for tonight's guest.
Fantastic. So everybody, tonight we have a very special guest on the show. He is legendary X-Men writer, co-creator of Deadpool and Shatterstar, wrote The New Warriors and just lots and lots of cool stuff. Cable, lots of stuff for Marvel. And he's also now producing a new book called X-Men Legends. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. And his name is Mr. Fabian Nicieza. And I hope I said that right. I'm sure he'll correct me if I haven't. So we're going to run the VT and we'll be with you shortly. And welcome back to the Icecast. And welcome to the Icecast, Mr. Fabian Nicieza. Have I said
Yay!
That correctly?
Well, you said the first name the way a denizen of the UK would say it. And you actually you nailed the last name perfectly, which is great.
Excellent.
Well done.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. I worked on that for a long time.
it's getting easier because it's been my pinned tweet for a few years now. So actually more people are getting it right as a result of just having it up there. That's been good too.
Well, that's good. I have a funny surname as well. Well, it's not that funny, but it's unusual.
It's spelled funny, yeah.
Yeah,
it's a different spelling, sure.
And a lot of people say it wrong, so I totally empathize with, you know, the whole feeling of people saying your name wrong. So I always try and get people's names right.
The way I think of it is, if my parents hadn't decided to leave Argentina for the United States when I was about 4 years old, I would have spent a life of hearing my name pronounced properly. That's all. You know, just their choice to come to the US not only gave me wonderful opportunities in my life, but it allowed me to live a life where my name would always be pronounced wrong. So
that's not a bad trade-off, is it?
I'll actually take it. I'm not complaining too much about it. It just gives me a reason to make fun of Americans. That's all.
Hey, there's always that's always good.
In the past, when you're announced on shows like this, or do people like suddenly mumble your surname? Hey, ladies and gentlemen, it's Fabian.
They'll just say Fabian sometimes, or they'll just butcher it, which is fine because it gives me an opening intro into the whole thing. Yeah. Anyway, I can start off by just verbally abusing the host of the show, but I couldn't do that this time because Shane got it right.
We still got a good few minutes out of it for the intro.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing too. Yeah, we were able to milk it out for a few minutes. That's pretty good.
So we'll dig straight into it because we've got a lot to cover. I was researching your career, although I didn't have to do much research because I own loads of your stuff because I grew up as a teenager and then a young adult in the 90s when you were really, really prolific and doing lots and lots of work. So I found that I was reading back into your career. I was like, yeah, I remember that. Oh, I loved that. So it's all mapped out sort of in my memory to a certain extent. But I didn't realize until I read up that you already worked for Marvel before you started as a writer, and you'd worked in publishing for many years. Isn't that right?
Not many, but I graduated college in 83. I got a job at Putnam Berkeley Publishing. Putnam was the hardcover house. Berkeley was the softcover house. I worked for Berkeley. And I worked there for a couple of years until I heard about a job opening at Marvel. And I applied for that job and got it in August of 85.
Right. Okay. So that was quite a while before you started actually writing then. Cause I try to think back, it was a Cyforce comic, wasn't it? That you,
yes, that was my first issue sold. And that was actually sold and printed in 1987. I actually had sold a story before that. I had sold a Spider-Man inventory story, but there was an editorial change and the previous editor hadn't even sent the plot out to get drawn, and the new editor didn't like the story, so it got killed. So really my first published sale could have and should have been a Spider-Man story, but it never happened. So it was kind of, it's kind of bittersweet in many ways in hindsight, but for the other side of the coin is it gave me a quick education about, you know, just the realities of publishing and how things work. It didn't deter me or anything like that. It just made me realize, okay, shit happens, you know? So you got to get ready for that. But I was already Marvel's advertising manager for almost a year, maybe a little less, because I took that job in 86. The first job I got at Marvel was an assistant in the manufacturing department, which isn't really what I wanted to do, but I just wanted to get my foot in the door. So my first sale was Cyforce, and it was an inventory story, which meant a completed story that just sat in a drawer. And when it was needed for the schedule, an editor had it available to them because it was already, you know, penciled, inked, lettered, and colored. So Jim Shooter had a policy that every editor had to have an inventory story in their drawer for every book they had. Because the goal was to make sure you met your shipping, and that meant newsstand more than anything, because you couldn't be late to the newsstand shipping or else you wouldn't even get the rack space for that slot. So the new universe books were in horrific scheduling shape. The line wasn't doing well after its launch, and Bob Budiansky, who's the editor, who's also very well known as the writer of Transformers and the creator of Bumblebee, the character. But Bob was the editor who asked me if I wanted to pitch any stories for Cyforce, and I said sure, yeah. And I went home and I read the first three issues because that's all that had come out at that point. And the next day I gave him like 10 pitches. And he wanted to buy one immediately, and he also wanted to buy a second one, which ended up becoming issue 13. And then Jim Shooter determined that I would be the monthly writer of Cyforce. So in a really quick span, kind of faster than normal for sure, within 6 months of my first sale, I was also a monthly comic book writer, and Cyforce was my monthly assignment starting with issue 16 until it ended with issue 34, I think, 34, 32.
Yeah, I think it was early 30s, yeah. So was writing something that you had aspirations for when you worked at Marvel? I mean, obviously, there must have been some desire there. I'm interested how you made that transition from like a more production role to from a sales role to then actually a creative role. That's quite a big leap, isn't
well,
it?
Well, actually, when you hear it, you'll realize it's very normal and natural. First of all, I wanted to write since I was about 10 years old. I knew that I wanted to write. I drew all the time too, but I knew that I wasn't a good enough artist. I just drew in service of the stories I wanted to tell. So I'd been writing short stories and comic book stories on sketch pads and drawing it myself. when I was between freshman year and sophomore year in high school during the summer, I wrote a book. Which was on loose leaf paper and in a three ring binder, but it was about 400 pages on loose leaf binder in my own handwriting. I didn't type it up or anything. So, you know, I did it because I wanted to see if I had long form storytelling in me, even at that age. You know, I was about 14, I guess, between 14 and 15. I ended up handing it in as an English assignment my sophomore year, and I got an A for it because the teacher didn't want to have to bother reading it. It was so damn long, so he just gave me an A. He was also my soccer coach. He was my JV soccer coach. So he just goes, yeah, I'm just gonna give you an A. I was like, all right, sounds like a fair exchange. You don't have to suffer through reading it, and I get a good grade. Okay. So I'd wanted to write all along. I went to college for communications major with a specialty in public relations and advertising. I wanted to get into a field that would put me writing adjacent that would give me opportunities to try to write. I couldn't get a job in advertising originally, so I got a job at Berkeley Publishing, and we did paperback books, and I was in production first, and then I was in managing editorial after that. And really, that's shuttling the books between editorial and production, who then shuttle the books between the office and the outside typesetters and all that. Back then, it was like, it was literally the original days before even keyboard typesetting. It was the days of old line type. And you guys are a little too young for that, but it was really kind of cool. You actually had to set every single metallic piece of type in a plate. Anyway, I was planning to start offering my pitches to Berkeley Publishing editors for some of the series books that they published. They did things like a Nick Carter spy series and Long Arm Western series and things like that. So my goal was, because they churned a lot of writers through those, you wrote manuscripts, but it was a pseudonym author on the cover for every month. You know, I don't even remember their names, but you know, the Nick Carter name, you know, could have been Johnny Hazard, whatever, and that would have been the author name every month. So I knew that those editors churn through a lot of material. So they're always looking for manuscripts. And I figured this is my way to get my foot in the door of writing while I'm working on staff. I'm getting to know the editors. They're getting to know me. I can show them I can write. I can show them I can handle a schedule. I can handle editorial commentary. I can handle rewrites, all of that stuff. And I was actually just a few weeks away from starting those pitches when I found out about the job opening at Marvel. So I went to interview there. And I'd already interviewed at Marvel in DC right out of college. I actually went through three rounds of interviews at both companies, and I didn't get either job, which was understandable because the jobs they were looking for required a little more experience than I had.
Yeah.
So when I started working at Marvel, the job I took was really just to get my foot in the door. And when I found out that the guy who got hired instead of me in 1983 was looking to hire an assistant, and his name was Steve Saffel, and he was the promotions manager, and he was looking to hire an assistant. So I interviewed for the job with him internally, and 4 months after starting at Marvel, I started Marvel August of 85. By January of 86, I had switched over to the promotions department. And it was actually a pay cut from what I was getting paid, but I wanted to be in the promotions department because that's what I went to school for. That's what I thought would give me a better opportunity to kind of make a difference, try to have something valuable to offer the company and the comic books. So we didn't know that we were getting a boss hired above us at the same time as Steve was hiring me. So all of a sudden we had a three-person department, and then publicity ended up getting grouped with that. So we became the promotions and publicity department, which hadn't existed before at Marvel. And instead of being an adjunct to direct sales, we, as an independent department, our services were offered to every department in the company, you know, whoever needed it, licensing, international publishing, international licensing, editorial, everyone. Right. So I became Marvel's advertising manager. And my job was to do all of the house ads, all of the promotional posters that went to comic book shops, all of the co-op ads, the sell sheets that we did for the direct market. I did all of that stuff. So any ad you see between 86 and 91, I think it was me writing the, and it's, in essence, you're also an editor because your job is to shepherd a project from start to finish. You have to come up with the copy. You have to hire the artist. You have to work through it with the art department and our internal production department. We ended up having so much work that we had an outside ad agency that was working on our stuff, most of our stuff. So I ended up having a shuttle between the office and down to Union Square, Manhattan, where her offices were. And I was putting together, 12 to 20 things a month that we had to do. So it was also a great way for me to get to know all the editors. I got to understand them. I got to know what they liked and what they didn't like, what their quirks were, what their idiosyncrasies were, all of that stuff. Mm. They got to know me too. And they got to know me as an enthusiastic guy with a lot of energy, a lot of arrogance, but worked really, really well in a team environment and was working for them. My job is to help you sell your book more. So don't fight me. because there used to be a lot of problems between editorial and direct sales.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there were. And it was a lot of political crap, a lot of different reasons. But the truth is that my engagement internally at Marvel, along with a few other people who came aboard at the company around the same time, and along with Jim Shooter leaving and Tom DeFalco becoming editor-in-chief, and Mark Grunwald becoming executive editor, it changed the internal dynamics at the company tremendously.
I bet.
The difference between when I started in 85 to when we were really hitting our stride in 88, 89, 90, the difference was kind of night and day in terms of interdepartmental cooperation and even interdepartmental socialization. People from direct sales wouldn't go out for beers with people from editorial. It just didn't really happen back then.
Oh, really?
And because a new wave of young people came in between direct sales and promotion publicity and even editorial, we ended up socializing a lot more than we used to as a group. So it became a little bit less of individual fiefdoms or fortresses. So I had a lot to do with that. I'm not the sole person responsible for any of that by any means. There were lots of people who were a part of that process, but I know that my engagement had a lot to do with that. I developed and fostered very strong friendships with Mark Grunwald and with Tom DeFalco while I was still in the promotions department. And that made a big difference in how we all interacted with each other. And
I bet.
It ended up just being a better company as a result of all of our agreement to start to work together rather than to work apart.
So that led you then, I guess, once Tom DeFalco was brought in, that was around the time that you were working on New Warriors, wasn't it?
Was that? Yeah, Tom was already there for a couple of years. Tom became editor-in-chief in 87, I think. I wanted New Warriors really badly. I knew that Tom was developing it with Ron. I knew Tom wasn't planning to write the monthly book. Danny Fingeroth returned up to staff as an editor. He had been an editor in the early 80s, got fired, and then was brought back, and he was going to be editing the book. So I had to pitch for that book just like anyone else.
What was your pitch to Marvel New Warriors? What was your pitch for that book?
You can read issues 1 through 25 and you roughly get an idea of what
exactly
my pitch was.
My
pitch didn't change all that much from what I put down on paper. The only difference was I was desperately trying to change the name of the book when I was pitching for it, because I thought that it was a kind of a dorky name. I also, with total respect for Tom and the kind of books he does, I also knew that how they were being presented in the first two Thor issues, along with Tom's little mini Bible that he had created, was not the kind of tone and approach and dialogue approach that I was planning to have for the book. So once I got the book, and it took many months before Danny made the decision and finally offered it to me. Mark Bagley and I got to start working on it, we hit the ground running. Danny knew really quickly that he had something good going. He knew it. And before issue one came out, we already had six issues in the drawer. We had completed six entire issues. So everyone internally at the office had started to see that this stuff was coming through the pipeline, because people see pages sporadically internally. Like sales may get direct sales may get two, three covers and a few interior pages. So they go, oh, that looks kind of cool. Oh, that dialogue's a little funny. The pages start cycling through production and the bullpen. So multiple people are seeing pages, not as a completed issue 99% of the time, but as a work in progress. So they'll see the difference between how Larry Malstead is inking Mark Bagley in issue number 3 versus how Al Williamson was doing it in issue number 1. And they go, oh, that looks a lot slicker. I like that look for this book better. And that's exactly what I felt too. So you start to get that internal buzz happening. And the original buzz on the book was really kind of negative, not so much negative to the content, because no one knew what the content was going to be, negative to the entire concept, because they thought it was going to be a dorky, hokey, Tom DeFalco-y kind of book. And my attitude was, I'm going to give you the best of what you know you love about Tom DeFalco's books, but I'm going to give it to you with a harsher edge. You know, I'm going to give it to you with a little bit of a colder clinical approach and better dialogue for the characters and the age set that we were dealing with.
The characters definitely had voices of their own, didn't they? I mean, that was something I noticed even back then when I was reading New Warriors, is that each character was so distinct in their dialogue. And that didn't always happen in superhero comics. You did not, you know, people sort of followed cliches, but each one of these characters was their own person, you know?
It's really hard to do. Hard to write a teen book and have everybody sound differently without forcing it. Like, you know, forced accents or forced tropes, you know? So I tried to do it by allowing each character's individual point of view and perspective to be presented through their dialogue and have a lot of debate and discussion between them, which allowed you to differentiate who each of them were based on their positions in the book regarding whatever the internal conflict of the story was, and by having their interaction be right there apparent on the page to you, so you hear their voices right in front of you. You know, I got a great compliment really early on, and it came from Mark, and he said, if someone reads your dialogue out loud with your eye, and you have your eyes closed or you're not looking at the book, you know exactly which character is talking. It was really, really good. And I don't know that I've had that consistently throughout my career. I hope I have, but I don't think I have. I know that you could have heard interchangeable dialogue in some of my X-Men writing or my X-Force writing, but New Warriors from the very beginning always had a very distinctive set of cadence and voice and tone for each of the characters speaking.
Definitely. We've had a comment there from Chris Ball. One of my favorite runs at Marvel characters going through difficulties while being young heroes. So definitely a fan there. Thanks for that, Chris.
I appreciate it, Chris, and he's also 100% right. I don't make any bones anymore. It's been 30 years. Anytime anyone talks about New Warriors positively, I just go, yes, you're right.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. It was a really good book. Thank you. I appreciate it tremendously. But looking back in hindsight over a 30-year career, yes. And those are the readers who were reading New Warriors on a monthly basis, actually, they got it. They knew that the book was doing fine. It was in Marvel's top 25. It wasn't a top 5 or top 10 book, but its sales were very strong and they climbed. They went up between year 1 and year 2, which is also great. I mean, issue 12 sold more than issue 1 did. And that's a great word. That means that you're getting great word of mouth and you're getting great buzz, right?
It doesn't
ever happen now. But issue one sold 126,000 to the direct market. It was the lowest selling title of the Heroes for the 96 title launch that year. And by issue 12, it was selling 210,000 copies. So you know, I watched it track up, which meant that it was working. That's all there is to it. Everything about the book was working. So the readers kind of got that too. So I always like my New Warriors readers because we are the proud, the few, and the intelligence. So I like that.
like a little cult almost.
In a positive way. I'd like to think of it more as the cool kids club than I do a cult. Okay.
We'll go with that. We'll go with that.
But this makes the perfect segue if you want to start talking about X-Men.
Well, that's what I was going to move on to. I was actually going to ask Ollie to move on to that, but we've lost him.
Where did Ollie go?
He just, I thought he was being really stoic and still, but his internet had frozen. So he's just disappeared for a while. So boop, there he goes. So yeah, I mean, X-Men. Could be described as something other than the cool kids, I guess. They were meant to be, in their conception originally, you know, an offbeat left field team. What was your take going on to X-Men originally? Obviously, this show is all about the new X-Men Legends book that you're working on, which we will talk about. But I'd just like to sort of go back and if you can think back to your take originally on Uncanny X-Men and how you felt about those characters.
It's interesting because I'm the guy who was about 12 years old, I think, or so, or 13 years old, and I bought Giant Size X-Men number one off the rack at a Krauser's convenience store. It's kind of like a 7-Eleven here in the United States, and
good
I
investment.
Bought it. I bought it not because I was a huge fan of the X-Men, because nobody on the planet was a huge fan of the X-Men back then. The book had been canceled. It was running as a reprint comic. You saw occasional appearances by them. I had issues of Captain America where a couple of them appeared. I had Marvel Team Up number 4 where the X-Men appeared. I had all those issues. I was familiar with them. I'd had some of the old 60s back issues that I'd gotten sporadically at flea markets, stuff like that, including, luckily for me, the debut of Havoc in issue 58 with that fantastic Neil Adams cover. I had that comic. I wasn't a big fan of the X-Men because there was no reason to be. Marvel clearly didn't care that much about them and didn't think that much about them. The reason I bought the comic is because Dave Cockrum was drawing it. And I was a huge fan of Dave Cockrum from when he was drawing Legion of Superheroes to when he moved over to Marvel and he was doing some inking on Avengers books. And then he did one of my favorite comics of all time, still to this day, which was Giant Size Avengers number 2, and this Hawkeye splash that you want to just die for. So that's why I picked up Giant Size X-Men number 1. And from that very first issue, Len Wein and Dave Cockrum had something really interesting and cool going. Yeah. So when the new monthly book came out, I bought it. And the first two issues were really good, and I kept getting it. And Chris took over, and Chris was really good. So clearly, I was there. I was there from the beginning, and I watched it get better and better and better. I watched it sell more and more and more. And as a reader, I loved it. And then I watched it go through its periods where it wasn't as enjoyable. And I was getting older, so there were things about it I was starting to like less. And I actually quit as a monthly buyer of X-Men a couple different times, and something always brought me back.
I think a lot of readers would say that, I think a lot of fans.
And I'm no different. So I walked into it no differently than any reader might, if they'd had the opportunity to write it. Ollie's back. Yay.
So welcome back, Ollie.
Welcome back, Ollie.
we thought you were just being really stoic and then realized that your internet had frozen and then you disappeared.
Chrome. It's the worst browser in the history of mankind and humankind. It doesn't like Max.
I will go head to head with you on crappy routers any day of the week, because if I make it through this entire podcast, it'll be amazing. I was just doing a friend of mine is teaching a class in New York, and I just did a Zoom guest visit on his class, and I got booted out of the thing 3 times in an hour and a half. It was just infuriating. I just there were things about X-Men I loved, and there were things about X-Men I did not love. Okay. Mm-hmm. And because I was there while all the turmoil was happening with Chris deciding, with the issues that the editor was having with Chris and Louise and Rob taking over on as the plotter on New Mutants, I was there for all of it, like more as a sounding board for Bob the editor than as a writer writing the books, right? And I didn't get the book after Chris left with issue 3 of X-Men. That the other guys kept plotting it, and John Byrne supposedly came into script for a month and a half until he quit. Mm-hmm. So me getting to work on those titles wasn't really something that I was necessarily attacking aggressively with vigor. At that time I was fighting. I was really enjoying working on New Warriors. I had quit Alpha Flight because I didn't think I should be writing a book that I wasn't that excited about. And I was really trying to sell a Two Gun Kid 4-issue Western series. I was working on New Mutants and flowing into X-Force. It was a challenging assignment, but I was getting paid a really, really good royalty paycheck for it. So I was going to keep doing it because I was a whore.
That was selling really well, wasn't it? New Mutants at the time was a top-selling book.
Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, this is
New Mutants 98. Rob's first issue sold about 600,000 copies, I think.
Wow.
The book had been selling about 250 before that in the direct market. Don't forget, we always sold another 100,000 minimum on newsstand back then too.
Yeah.
And X-Force number one sold 6 million. And everyone talks about that, and it's multiple covers and blah blah blah. But people don't want to think about the fact that X-Force number two sold 1.2 million, and that Whoa. Didn't have extra covers and stuff like
Wow.
that. It was
That's
just
amazing.
Retailers have a formula for how they de-escalate book sales.
Yeah.
Issue. So if issue one sells 100,000 copies. Issue two, yeah. you're going to order at 70% of that. Issue three, you're going to yeah. order at 50% of that. So even if they reduce their orders drastically on X-Force number one, that because of how much X-Force number one sold, that means X-Force number two is still going to sell a crapload of books, you know?
Crazy.
So the royalty checks were just too good. And even yeah. though the writing of it on a monthly basis was a challenge, sometimes it was fun, sometimes it was annoying and frustrating, and it really varied month to month what that was going to be. Plus all the image stuff was happening and percolating yeah. all through the first year of X-Force. There was a lot of turmoil, a lot of changeover, and a lot of potential for what was going to be next. So I Bob asked me to do two issues of X-Men as almost like inventory stories, as a placeholder, because he didn't know if and when Jim Lee was going to stop plotting the book. And I said, okay, fine. So I wrote issues 12 and 13 for him. And in that interim period, Jim left the book completely, as did Wills, mm-hmm. as did Rob. And I became the X-Men writer, but I got to be honest with you guys, 30 years later, the editor of that title never offered me the book. The words never came out of Bob's mouth. I want you to write X-Men.
So it was default. You were just.
It was absolutely a default that Scott was going to write Uncanny because he'd already been scripting that book over Wilson Jim's plots. And I was going to become the writer of X-Men. And there was never any kind of formal ceremony. There was never any rituals of drinking. No drinking of blood. No nothing like that. We immediately had to go into a crossover because the crossover was always budgeted for that quarter. We always knew there was going to be a crossover that quarter because it had been budgeted for that quarter the year before. The Image guys knew that too, and I to this day, as much as I respect the living daylights out of what they did, because it took tremendously giant balls to do what they did, I still feel very strongly that they waited as long as they possibly could to officially leave the titles, because they thought that the longer they waited, the more that would throw a monkey wrench into our ability to do the crossover. And if our first shot out of the canon was a dud, then everyone would have been saying, oh, the books are in trouble because those guys left, you know? And our schedule was like this, right up against the wall to get that crossover done. But we did it, and the Executioner song sold tremendously well. The audience, for the most part, really liked what was going on. It was a shit show of a storyline with a thousand things going on at once, and I can say that because I'm the one who broke down the entire storyline. But what it did very successfully is it cemented in the minds of the readers, especially the new readers who had come aboard in the last year, of which there were hundreds of thousands of them. It told them that this is going to be just as exciting as what you'd been reading. So it's okay that Rob isn't drawing Next Force anymore, because this guy, Greg Capullo, is drawing the living hell out of it, right?
And
it's okay that Jim Lee isn't drawing X-Men, because you know what? This guy, Andy Kubert, is really a strong, good artist. You know what I mean? So it allowed us, in an odd way, it gave us the breathing room to figure out what the hell we were going to do on the books, because we had to jump into the crossover so quickly that that we had no time to think about what the books were going to be. We just had to do this story. This 9-part thing had to be done. Let's do it. Wow. And then everybody got a chance to breathe and think about what their book was going to be. And that's the better effect than others. I mean, I think my first several issues of X-Men sucked, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do with the book. And Scott's first issues of Uncanny were better because he had a better idea of what he wanted to do. Peter David's issues of X-Factor were fantastic because he got to explore these characters that in a way that they hadn't really been explored before, you know? And it was just kind of cool. So I've described it many, many times, and I described it this way in 1994 when the Executioner's Song Trade paperback originally came out. And my foreword to that book starts off by saying it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. That's exactly what it was. It was really, really good, and it was really, really bad all at the same time. And I mean that in all ways, you know, in all ways, qualitatively, as far as the work goes, emotionally, as far as what went into having to work in this office on a month-to-month basis, you know, the rotating artists on some titles, all of this stuff, you know, but the books were selling like crazy. We had a whole bunch of new readers from the cartoon who were on board. We had to try to appease readers who had been reading it for almost 20 years at that point, and readers who had been reading it for 20 minutes.
A real balancing act.
It was always a monthly balancing act that became very, very exhausting.
Two different generations of fans there. And I've got a comment here from Mark Abnett. My first trade paperback, Executioner's Song, Wish X of Swords was somewhere close to it. Okay. That's the X of Swords.
I won't be reading X of Swords for another year or so when I can get a digital trade paperback up. So I can't tell you whether you're right or not, Mark. Sorry. but Mark, I got to be honest with you, and it's a great opportunity to make the comment. No comic is ever as good as the comics we read as boys when we were 12, 16 years old. It is your emotional touchstone for the rest of your comic book reading life if you like superhero comics. So there's no comic that I've ever read in my life that are as good as the ones I read between 12 and 16. So that's Jim Starlin's Captain Marvel and Warlock, and Steve Englehart's run into Jim Shooter's run on Avengers. That's always going to be the best for me. Mm. So I never read anything now as a soon-to-be 59-year-old man thinking that I should be getting the kind of enjoyment the way I got it when I was 14 years old. What I want to read it for is to see if the creative people have that spark of energy to their work. So if you're not enjoying X of Swords, it might not be because they're not producing a good book. It might be because you're fucking 45 years old. For the love of God, when you stop reading superhero comics. What the hell is wrong with you? You arrested adolescent man child.
I can say I know Mark, and he does read other stuff. but I find myself saying that to a lot of people, actually. It's, you know, they're dissatisfied with the churn out superhero stuff. And I say, well, read something else, you know? It's probably not aimed at you, you know.
To give it an analogy that I think I've used before and I think really works, reading X-Men every month for 30 years is the equivalent of watching a soap opera, every day for 30 years and complaining that the storylines now aren't what they were like when you first started watching it 30 years earlier. Storylines are exactly what they were like. You've probably just seen it 50 times already. So you're exhausted by it. You're bored by it. So give it a rest. Maybe you shouldn't be reading superhero comics if you're complaining too much. And I'm not just talking about you, Mark. I'm just saying in general, maybe you shouldn't read the superhero comics if you're not getting enjoyment out of them.
If we weren't reading comics, we wouldn't be able to read the X-Men Legends that's coming out soon.
Oh, good segue.
See what I did?
Brilliant segue. it'll be a comic that all 40-year-old arrested adolescent man boys will be able to enjoy.
First issue six. How many covers has the first issue got?
And there's a comment there from Chris, 46, still reading superheroes, still loving it. Juggernaut for one thing. Oh, there's another segue there.
But I mean, I gotta make an exception to any of the books I write, of course, because any of the books I write are fantastic, and you're gonna love them.
So anybody
who's younger than me, you're not gonna enjoy their books.
So what's the deal with Marvel Legends then? Because obviously there are other people involved, such as Chris Claremont. Mm-hmm. What's your involvement with it, and how much editorial freedom are you given in tying up loose ends or going back to certain storylines and taking it from a different angle, maybe?
Well, first off, X-Men Legends is planned as an anthology book. So it will be different length stories by different creative people. I have no idea who's following me, although I know the list of names that they put out, and they're obvious names that they put out. The goal is for all of us to get to the way it was presented to me is tell the stories you didn't get to tell back then. A little more so than tell stories you want to tell now. And there is a difference, I think. I don't have a lot of X-Men stories I'm interested in telling now because I haven't really followed the characters that much at all over the last 25 years.
Well, you're not 14 anymore, are you?
Nah, I'm not a man boy anymore. I'm not even 40 anymore. I'm an arrested adolescent senior citizen. And I had a few stories that I didn't get to tell back then. But not a lot. And most of that is because there came a point in my writing the monthly X-Men books where I stopped coming up with new stuff because I wasn't going to be allowed to develop it the way I wanted to or needed to. 100,000 ideas were always going to be thrown up against the wall between Bob and Scott. And the two of them were like moths with lights blinking on and off all around them. So I always abandoned the stories that I wanted to do because they were abandoned for me by editorial.
Right.
But that being said, there certainly were a few. So they asked me for a 2-part pitch and a 1-issue pitch and told me I'd have 3 issues in the first year of the book. So the only 2-part story I wanted to do was Adam X. And I told them that if you guys are ready to do it, there is a beginning, a middle, and an end to the story. The story was always intended to end in a way that takes you off the hook. And if I don't get to do the story this way, the way I'm going to present it to you in a synopsis, I'm fine not doing it at all. I would have been fine not doing it at all. It's been a long, long time. It's way water under the bridge for me. I told him I haven't read any of the Vulcan stuff that happened 10, 15 years ago. I'm not going to read any of that stuff because you're telling me to tell stories that are happening at the time of the original continuity. So my Adam X story was always planned to take place a few months after X-Men 39 and after Captain Marvel number 3. And that was going to be the miniseries that I wanted to do. I wanted to do a miniseries with Jeff Johnson, the artist on Wonder Man back then. Jeff even drew a few sample pages that looked really cool. And I never got to tell that story. So that's the story I want to tell. And the editor, Mark Basso, said, absolutely, we're all for it. Let's do it. And I said, okay, but just so you know, I'm going to quit at a minute's notice, okay? And Mark is like, no, it's all right. Every step of the way, I was like, I'm going to quit. And I got to be honest, guys, I meant it. If they had said, no, we don't want this flower to be blue, I probably would have said, okay, I'm done. I don't need to do it. Thank you. You know what I mean? And to their credit, Mark's credit especially, he really helped make it a stronger story through his editorial input because I was trying to condense 88 pages of original content that I had in really rough note form and outline form into 40 pages of content. And I scripted the first 2 issues together. I handed them in together. Mark gave me some great feedback to tweak, to tighten, to try to hit a few notes here and there because we are compressed and we are tight for space. Then he came back to me and said, we're going to add 10 pages to the first part because it's going to be issue number one of X-Men Legends, which I didn't know going in. So I thought, wow, they must really love the story. Then I realized I was an editor too. It's not that. We're probably just further along on the production pipeline than anybody else is. That's when they decided to make the first story. I wrote it with Brett Booth in mind, but we did not have him as the artist then. He hadn't done a lot of work for Marvel at all in years. I asked for him, and the editor said, oh, we just were talking about him last week in the office. Considering offering him some stuff. I said, well, I wrote this now with him in mind. I think he's the perfect choice for the kind of storytelling we're looking for, the kind of energy we want out of it, and how I visualize these characters. Plus, I knew Brett loved Cyclops, so that was cool too. And they offered it to Brett, and Brett said absolutely he wanted to do it. So we're rocking. He's already drawn like 5-6 pages. It looks great. Whatever you like or dislike about the 90s and whatever you might like or dislike about Brett and whatever you might like or dislike about my writing, guess what? It's all there.
Yeah.
All there for you.
Honestly, it's like there's been no gap at all. It's like, from what I've seen of it, it's just so genuinely nostalgic of that period.
I didn't write it. I wrote it like me today. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right, okay.
I didn't write it like me back then.
Yeah. I suppose there'd be no point in doing that, would there? You know, as a writer, that would be pretty dull, wouldn't it?
And I just think I got to be honest with you, maybe I'm fooling myself, but I just think I'm a much better writer now than I was when I was 30. I just do. And I also have 30 years of experience under my belt telling stories, and I can tell the story of this character better now because of it. This character was always meant to be a sadly tragic character. I failed to introduce him properly because my strategy was flawed, and my strategy was to introduce him as a bombastic early 90s Liefeldian kind of excessive thing. But I knew his story wasn't that. I knew that all along. So my goal was to introduce him this way through bombast, and then little by little start to show the depth, start to show nuances to the character, some sadness as he started learning more. And I was trying to do it. I just didn't get enough of a chance to do it because of constant editorial muddling in schedules and plans for the issues. But I also didn't do a good enough job personally. And I know that. I'm well aware. Look, there he is. There's Adam.
That's brilliant.
The Captain Marvel issue. So this gives me a chance to tell the story of that character. And for better or worse, it is almost exactly what I wanted it to be. I'm missing out the opportunity to flesh out a couple parts of the story. So some things happen, and I don't want to give it away. Some things happen kind of big bang quickly, and we cut jump to the next thing that has to happen in the story. And originally there was going to be space there to tell the between point A and point B, you know? But all that being said, it's the story I wanted to tell. It's how I wanted to tell it. The beginning is what I wanted it to be. The ending is what I wanted it to be. We fudged around a bit with some of the middle stuff. But the big highlights, the big events, the big money shots that Brett gets to draw, that's all a part of this still. And I think it's kind of cool. I think it's a good story. I always did. It was for me back then, it was my X-Men version of Luke Skywalker. That's what it was always.
Right.
Made. Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. With the mullet.
And I the mullet. It wasn't so much a mullet, Ollie. It was
no.
Going beautiful.
Listen, we all had them back in the 90s and earlier, yeah. And I had one in the 80s.
Speak for yourself, mate. Speak for yourself. I've got a comment here. It says it's from us, but it's probably from Sam, the invisible man in the background there. What's all this lumpy white stuff? What are you talking about, Sam? What is that comment? Silence. I don't know what that comment means. It sounds rude, though. It sounds very rude, so I'm not going to pursue it. We have had some other comments as well.
I'm doing that off on the side.
Yeah, he's being a sneak. He's being a sneak on the side.
He's trying to sabotage the entire broadcast from the side.
Yeah. I don't know what he's doing.
Do you know what? For the majority of...
a water bottle at a player who's on a breakaway. You don't do that from the sidelines, man. Let the play happen.
I've been in, all this time, I've been imagining an alternative universe, maybe the Marvel 617, where your coach gave you an A for soccer and a C for English, and somewhere you're the new Maradona for the New York Cosmos.
I wish, man. I never would have done that. I didn't start because soccer was just starting to kind of get a foothold in the early 70s. I didn't start playing until eighth grade. So
I'm assuming your family brought that tradition with them from Argentina, because I know this.
My dad found out about the soccer league that was in the early 70s and only been going on for a couple of years, and he volunteered to coach. And he was started to coach a recreational soccer team in Old Bridge, New Jersey in 73, I think. The team was really bad, and I told him, I'll play on the team, Dad, even though I never played soccer before. My natural arrogance made me think, how hard could it be? Just picking a rock. I dislocated my elbow that fall in gym class at school. So I was out for five, six. I only got to play like three games out of a 10-game schedule. But I kept playing. I kept playing after that. I played for the high school team.
Right.
And I started coaching too. I've coached soccer on and off for over 16 years.
Wow.
Whether it was when I was younger coaching, all through college, I coached recreation and travel teams. And then when my daughter and my son started playing, I was coaching their teams too. But I never got to be a good enough player because I just started too late, you know? But my dad could do things with a soccer ball. It's so cool. Like we went to a basketball court one time, and he started like just kicking, bouncing the ball, and then just kicking it through the hoop.
Wow, that is professional. Maybe like skill.
14 shots in a row, just tapping it, tapping it, tapping it.
Right, I bet you the local kids were stunned, were they?
Yeah, no. It was like my dad played soccer in Argentina. He told me that they either used to use oranges or they used to use wrapped up socks. Because most of the kids didn't have soccer balls back then growing up, you know. And he was a good player. My dad was a good player. He just never, you know, like anybody player in Argentina, you could be a really good player. That doesn't mean anything. But everyone else is a really good player too.
And do you follow soccer? Have you got a particular team you follow nowadays then?
Yeah, not too much. I watch the U.S. national team when they're playing. Mostly
that doesn't count.
I watch the women's team.
Yeah.
So I don't follow European soccer that much. I'll watch some stuff when it's on. I watch highlights a lot too. Soccer's boring, man. Watching a whole game is exhausting. I'd rather watch hockey.
Yeah, I like rugby. That's my game. I like the rugby.
Rugby's a good game to watch, actually. It really is. Yeah.
We had a comment there from Chris.
I'm not as much of a man as you are, Shane, okay? I clearly I don't have the testosterone you do to play rugby.
I didn't want to play it at school, but I was made.
Yeah, you're forced into it. Because
I was a big guy at school. Well, I still am, I guess. But I was a prop on rugby, and I didn't want to play it. I was sort of forced into it. But then, of course, after two or three years of playing, you start to like it.
Yeah.
And it's a great game. It's a great game to watch as well. I really like the fact that it's so physical, you know.
I was never a big guy in high school here in the United States. You end up getting stuck as an offensive lineman in football. And it's just like just the exhausting drudgery of having to be an offensive lineman. It's just not my cup of tea.
Take a lot of punishment.
What's going on? We're talking about sports. We're going to lose our audience.
Yeah, man. We don't want to lose them. Well, listen,
The men boys are fleeing.
Going back to the original New 52, I really enjoyed Legion Lost. Now, I know you weren't on it for that long.
You, Ollie, you got to just like, you got to, if there's a fast forward button, you got to just fast forward past me. You can't say you liked Legion Lost. It's like saying you like Enemas. You got to just go right by it, right? It's over.
Hey, there's no bad characters, just bad creators. That's what I was always about.
It was one of the three worst experiences of my career. Yes, bar none.
And did you have to pitch for that, or did they come looking for you and then before you knew
They offered me the title. They had already decided they wanted to do a book of a group of Legionnaires lost in our time, disconnected from the Legion book, because they weren't going to be doing a Legion book. Mm. They didn't have a clue what they wanted the Legion to be yet. And they still don't have a clue, obviously. So they offered me Legion Lost, and I jumped at it because Dawnstar and Wildfire, Werewolf, and even Tyrock, that's all of my generation, my time when I originally read Legion. And as much as I love the Levitz Giffen stuff and all that, I was 11, 12 years old when I saw Dave Cockrum drawing Legion Superhero. Mm. Okay. Mm. And then Mike Grell took over, and well, he was pretty cool too. He wasn't Dave Cockrum, but he was pretty cool. And he drew a lot of skin on the women character. So that was okay too.
You're that age, but that impressed you.
I was 11, 12 years old when I read that. So they gave me the group, and I said, that's a great group. That's a great combination of characters. I love that. I can't wait to do this. They told me, we want this to be like the new 52's X-Men.
So what went wrong?
let's not discuss what.
Okay. I'm just, because we've got 2 minutes left, I thought I'd just squeeze.
We can squeeze a bit more. So we've got a couple of.
What went wrong was editorial. Incompetence. That's all.
I
can't even put it any other way. These are people, some of whom I've known for 25 years, and I like them very much as friends, but they leave a lot to be desired when they're put in editorial positions of responsibility that require something called decision making. So that is part and parcel everything that's wrong with New 52.
Okay, I like it. So we've had a couple of comments.
Oh, yeah.
Deadpool now owns Wrexham Football Club. So we're talking comics and football there. So, yeah, of course, Ryan Reynolds.
I would love if Ryan Reynolds has so many zeros that he can start buying football clubs that he'd just throw a couple more zeros my way. I get zeros, but he gets lots more zeros than me. So... Look, if he wants to buy me, he can do that. He can buy me. I am a whore. I am here for you, Ryan. Buy me. Stop spending your money on gin and soccer.
Yeah, it's a waste of money, gin. It'll never catch on.
How many sold a company for like $1 billion? What did he sell that company for? I don't even want to know.
It's a ridiculous amount, yes.
Crazy. All the freaking Deadpool money. He's just turning into more money. It's amazing.
He's just having fun with it, isn't he, as well?
Yeah. So Wrexham's only cost him $2 million between the two of them because it's a very lowly club. Oldest club in Wales. I'm sure Sam Morgan would have told me that.
It's only 40 miles. It's 40 miles down the road from where I live.
Oh, it's what? Yeah. College there?
Yeah, it was me too. I went to art college in Wrexham. We've got a comment from Mark as well, staying on the sports. You're way too short to be a prop, Shane. Take it from a Kiwi. Can see you as a ranging hooker hanging out on the wing.
I can see him as a raging hooker.
Raging hooker.
He could be a raging hooker that has a lot of blocks to cover. So he's a ranging hooker too.
I'm glad you didn't have a misspell there, Mark, but thanks for that. So I was a prop for a while. They didn't have much choice in my school. There wasn't much to choose from. That's all I can say. So we would be doing our sort of Deadpool fans who are watching a misservice if we didn't talk about Deadpool a little bit. the only question I had really was, when you and Rob came up with Deadpool, did you think at the time this is going to be a massive character, or was it just day at the office, carry on with the work, or did you feel this is something special?
Well, first of all, Rob came up with Deadpool. I came up with Deadpool after Rob came up with Deadpool. So the character's name and the character's visual is solely wholly the creation of Rob. The character's personality, the character's tragedies, the character's conflicts and flaws really are the sole province of me. And plenty of other people afterwards, obviously. Mm-hmm. But we knew within days of New Mutants 98 coming out that he had struck a really fun, positive chord with the audience. Simple as that. Because the mail on New Mutants 98 was the usual stack of mail for New Mutants 98 was like this, and the mail we got on New Mutants 98 was like that. You see,
wow,
completely out of the box. Okay,
wow.
And I know this because I read every piece of mail that came in for the books I wrote, because I worked on staff, so I could go down to the mailroom, I could steal it from the chute, I could read it, I could rubber band it back up, I could put it back in the chute, and then the editors would read it. I wrote all the mail before the editor did, and 75% of that mail said this guy was funny, bring him back.
So you got rid of the 25% that wasn't needed.
Yeah, 25% just talked about how cool Rusty and Skids are. I don't know.
Rusty and Skids.
So the editor, Bob Harris, stopped me in the hall a week or two after that and said, "Did you see the mail on New Mutants yet?" I go, "No, I haven't really seen it." Because I didn't want, I wanted to read it unfiltered from the editors, because the editors are going to give you their own biases and they're going to pluck out what they got out of the audience to suit their own biases. So I didn't want him to know I'd read all the mail, but he goes, "They really like Deadpool. They think he's funny. We should bring him back." It was almost like Obi-Wan Kenobi and the droid. You know? And Rob was going to bring him back anyway, but by then we were already working on X-Force, you know, number one. Mm. And Rob wasn't going to bring Deadpool back until X-Force number two. So in order to appease what we saw as an immediate response on the part of the audience, Deadpool was one of five trading cards in X-Force number one, less than 3-4 months after the character debuted. If we didn't know right off the bat that there was something cool about this guy, why would we ever have made him part of a marketing publishing plan for 6 million comics going out, right?
Yeah.
Deadpool got his own card in one of those five books. So anybody who doesn't understand that doesn't understand the realities of how publishing works. If we didn't think immediately that Deadpool was kind of cool and we should do whatever we can to stoke him, he wouldn't have been a trading card, would he?
Logical. That is logical.
People have an illusion about history, and usually the people who lived history have a slightly better understanding of it. And we knew that Deadpool was popular right off the bat. And the first miniseries that you're showing on screen now took a little while to come out, because we had to wait to see if Rob was going to do it. And that took a year. Then I started writing it immediately, but then Joe Madureira was going to draw it. And he was a little slow at that time. He was also 18 years old at that time.
Whoa, really?
Yeah, Joe was only 18 years old. He sold his first story to Marvel Comics Presents when he was like 17 years old. So Joe was going to draw it, and it took a little time for him to draw it, which is why the first miniseries didn't come out until 94, I think it was. If we had had our druthers, that miniseries probably would have come out almost a year earlier. There were too many things competing against it and preventing us from being able to do it. So the minute Rob was going to leave and he wasn't going to do the Deadpool miniseries, Bob asked me if I could do it. And I just did what I did. Whatever you see from page one onward, any background stuff, anything with the cancer, anything with his skin conditions and his problems, all of that stuff is there on the page. And I started to develop it. I wanted to show what he looked like without his mask on in that miniseries. I wrote it, and Bob asked me to change it and make it subtler because he didn't want to give away everything. So, you know, 30 years of hindsight is frustrating because I wanted to be the one to reveal that. but it is what it is, you know. And I was supposed to write the second miniseries, and I broke the whole thing down, and editorial rejected it completely because it was his origin story, and it was pretty dark. And they didn't want to go dark with the character.
Right.
They wanted to keep it fun. Even back then, they wanted it to be a little lighter. And I said, there's going to be plenty of humor, really, really dark. Dark humor, really black, dark humor. But they didn't want to do that. So they actually gave it to Mark Waid to write, and they, whatever it was, I didn't read that thing for 10, 15 years. And I still hate it to this day. So, I wanted to tell the origin story and I didn't get a chance to. And the origin story is basically roughly what Joe did in the Deadpool annual and what Ryan and Rhett and Paul did in the movie. But the way I was going to structure it is that his cancer came back and he was furious at the scientists who did this to him because they sold him a bill of goods. So he starts tracking down all the scientists that were part of the Weapon X program. Every time he confronts one of them, we flash back to the past and what happened to him to make him this way. So, by the end of the story, he was going to be able to keep fighting the cancer, but it was going to be an unwinnable perpetual fight. If his cellular regeneration ever stops, the cancer kills him. Simple as that. Yeah. Right? So he'll always be a monster in order to be alive. It wasn't peppy and happy and fun. But I think it would have made a really, really good story for the character.
I like it because it makes him more human. It makes him more vulnerable, because my only criticism of Deadpool these days when I read it occasionally is that he's just unkillable. He doesn't seem to have any weaknesses. And I love the idea that, there's this perpetual threat to his existence, always there, that dark sort of in the background threat to his life and the fact that he could die. I think that makes him a lot more human, a lot more relatable. One of the comments we've had here from Chris was, some of the best Deadpool stories are the darker ones. He didn't say that exactly, but I've rephrased him. But I'll go with that. So,
I don't read a lot of Deadpool comics, and by saying that, I mean I almost read no Deadpool comics ever. I just know that, and I could probably predict, without having read them, the sequence of events that leads to writers and artists constantly trying to one-up whatever came before. So that's a flaw in monthly sequential writing that is an individual quirk that you have to fight against. So if I'm a writer and I take over Deadpool and the last writer wrote a storyline where he got beheaded and his head got run through a sausage grinder and then he grew a new head. Okay, I got to top that. So I'm going to have him swallow an atom bomb and the bomb is going to go off and then he's going to reform from that. And then the next writer goes, oh, I'm going to top that. Only one cell exists and he's going to regrow from one. And it just becomes this ludicrous game. And that's what ends up happening when you're trying to it's a Wile E. Coyote Roadrunner situation where you're constantly trying to get a bigger, better Acme bomb, And I never approached Deadpool that way because I had no interest in approaching Deadpool that way because, I didn't know or care whether he was going to be published forever. My Deadpool and literally in Cable and Deadpool, he got beheaded by Wolverine. And they said, if we don't reattach his head in a certain amount of time, the oxygen deprivation to his brain is going to kill him, right? Because his head got severed, right? Of course, when you reattach the head, then he starts to heal up immediately. You know what I mean? So I had Bob, Agent of Hydra, trying to pick up his head in the middle of this big fight going on. And then he put it on backwards by accident. Zach Deadpool, to me, the minute you go too far beyond that, it's unsustainable. And then you can't believe the character because anything happening, like you said, Shane, is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. And you just can't relate to him. We've had a comment from Mark Abnett again. Thank you, Fabian, for giving us the personalities of Cable and Deadpool and especially all 50 issues of the Cable Deadpool series.
You are very welcome, Mark. It's Deadpool is like my second favorite assignment of my career. So
those two characters go well together, don't they?
I didn't know if they would, to tell you the truth. They asked me to write the book, and my first impression was, was a split book like Tales of Suspense or Tales to Astonish back in the 60s, you know, 11 pages of Deadpool and 11 pages of Cable. And Mike Martz, the editor who called me and offered it to me, said, no, no, a book with them together. And I said, like The Odd Couple? And he goes, yeah. Like The Odd Couple. And I go, oh, okay. And he goes, just, you know, and he calls me like on a Wednesday. He says, just get me, try to get me a proposal by Friday. I was like, Friday? He goes, okay, try to get me a proposal by Monday. I was like, okay. And I hadn't done any work for Marvel at that point in like almost 6 months, which had been the longest I hadn't done any work for Marvel since 98 after I left Acclaim. And they offered me Gambit. So I kind of wanted to get back in to Marvel because Bill Jemis was the new president and Joe Quesada was the new editor-in-chief. And I thought they thought I was passe. So I was like, all right, yeah, yeah, I can do this. No problem. And goes, sure, it's going to be great. And I hang up the phone and I distinctly remember looking out my office window back then at the house I was living in, looking out the window. And I said to myself, how the hell am I going to do a book with these two guys in it every issue without them wanting to kill each other? And I go, wait a minute. Of course they want to kill each other. Okay, there's the first 5-6 issues right there. Okay. I gave myself enough time and spin enough plates that it gave me the opportunity to figure out how it was going to work. And I totally figured it out through the course of those first 6 issues because it started to play into everything after that. And for me, the beauty of that book is that the reason they are together is because neither one of them have anyone else. Simple as that. They're such lonely people, the two of them, that it's almost impossible for them to have the kind of social connections they need to feel fulfilled. So they're willing to substitute normal, healthy human relationships with the relationship they had with each other because it was a rationalizing way to handle all of the issues and problems they both have, right? And that was it. So once I got to that point, writing the book was absolute pleasure because no matter what the two of them did to each other, no matter how mad they might get at each other, no matter how often they double-crossed each other, they were always going to have to gravitate back to each other because they couldn't gravitate to anyone else, you know? That's kind of the way I approached it.
And it worked.
Mark, you're a savvy, smart reader, I can tell.
There you go, Mark. That's a good answer for you there.
He's liking New Warriors and he's liking Cable and Deadpool. This guy's the best. If he tells me he likes NFL Super Pro, I want him booted off.
Are you enjoying Juggernaut, Mark? That is the next question.
Yeah, Mark, I'm sure.
Because I liked writing it tremendously. It was a lot of fun.
How did that come about then, Fabian? How did that gig come about?
Last September, the week after Labor Day here in the United States, which is like the first week of September, was one of the most fascinating, interesting, exciting weeks I've had in my career in probably ever. I found out that an agent was going to represent me for my book manuscript, and that's vital to trying to sell your book. I found out that an animation Bible that I had written was going to be optioned for development. Even though I had no interest in writing the actual animated stories, it was fun to see the Bible get picked up. And I got a phone call from Jordan White, the ex-editor at Marvel, and I had not written anything new for Marvel other than a lot of custom comics, which are things you don't see because it's all the business-related comic book publishing they do.
Right.
Clients and pharmaceutical companies and things like that. Okay. I've done a lot of those, but none of those are for consumer consumption. Jordan called me up. Look at you pulling that up quickly. Sam doing that. Sam's trouble.
Career highlight.
That's Sam, Sam.
Jordan called me up and said, would you be interested in doing a Juggernaut miniseries? And I said, I love Juggernaut. What's up? And he said, well, are you familiar with what's going on with the X-books right now with Jonathan Hickman? And I go, yeah, I actually bought the House of X and Powers of X miniseries as they were coming out. I was just curious to see what Hickman was going to do. And he goes, well, Juggernaut isn't allowed on Krakoa because he's not a mutant. So what's he going to do? And I said, oh, yeah, I'm in. I'm totally in. I said, but Jordan, be aware, I wrote a miniseries for Marvel 15, 20 years ago called X-Men Forever, which was me trying to set up a status quo for Juggernaut outside of the X universe that gives him his own standing ground. And Jordan said, oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that one. I go, Marvel ignored the status quo I set up like 2 weeks after the last issue of the book release. And I don't care now the way I did back then. I said, quite frankly, I could set up a new status quo for him and you guys can ignore it a month later. I don't care. But my goal is to set up a status quo for Juggernaut that exists outside of the X-Men. And he said, that's exactly what we're looking for. I said, okay, yeah. So I started writing it. I wrote all five issues and I was done with it by last January. And it just, because of the COVID delay, it's just coming out now. But, you know, I finished the fifth issue of this back in January of this year. So it's kind of rear view mirror for me in a way creatively. But it's enjoyable to see it coming out now and seeing the reactions from people. I was very happy with it. They were pretty happy with it because they've offered me more work afterwards. And I like the character tremendously. But that's with the caveat that I haven't read all of his appearances, certainly not since 2004 when I did X-Men Forever. I have almost no clue what's gone on with him between then and now. Jordan just updated me on the status quo. He said, oh, by the way, his gem got ripped out and crushed and he got kicked into limbo. But you don't have to address that if you don't want to. I go, how am I not going to address that? And he goes, well, whatever you want to do. And I was like, okay, fine. So I made that a part of the storyline, obviously. The flashbacks to what happened 6 months ago, 4 months ago, is really the quest for Kane to try to regain some semblance of power because he feels he's nothing without power. And that's his past. That's his recent past. That leads you to his present day where he realizes that power isn't enough to be someone. So who's he going to be? So I'm trying to dovetail both ends of the story, his quest to reclaim power and then his realization that he has to do something with that power, that just having power isn't enough for him anymore, whereas it always used to be. So I'm trying to dovetail and mirror those two things happening at the same time in the miniseries, and those flashbacks continue for the next two issues as well. And every step of the way, you're coming to realize that it's a slightly different Juggernaut, it's a slightly different armor, it's a slightly different power range. I'm sorry, Juggernaut fans. Yes, right now he is weaker because he doesn't have the gem of Sidorak inside him. And what he has inside him, you'll get to see in the next couple issues. And I think it's kind of clever. Jordan loved it. And it's a combination of things for him now. So what you just saw in this issue that just came out is that he has stabilized crimson bands of Sidorak as like an under harness to the armor. And that's actually creating invulnerability and protection and empowering him to enlarge in himself. And you'll see other aspects of how that armor came together in the next couple issues as well.
Mm-hmm. We've had a comment. I'm just trying to make it out. You guys might be able to shed some light on it. Is there any successful answer to the one-upmanship inflation in comics? To think we read to escape real-world problems, if it ain't house prices, it's plot lines. Not sure what to make of that question, to be honest.
I think this is obviously referring back to the one-upmanship.
We're watching a few different things together. If you mean one-upmanship inflation in terms of storytelling, my answer to that is it's the individual responsibility of the writer to know that sometimes more isn't necessarily better. And many writers lack that ability to hold back. They lack the ability to go, yes, that's a great idea, but maybe it's not a great idea for the long run. And part of the reason for that is a generational change in how creative people approach work for hire characters. When I started at Marvel, when Peter David was writing and starting at Marvel, he'll tell you, we thought our goal was to be on a book for 100 issues. Okay. Yeah. Nowadays, the guys go in knowing that they may get 12 issues at most, you know?
Yeah.
because of the nature of publishing now and the cyclical change in how people are staying on books. So they lack the discipline to worry about how this affects you 25 issues from now, because they're not going to be writing at 25 issues from now. And they also lack, I just don't have the right verbiage for what I'm trying to say. They lack the respect for what needs to be considered for the long-term stability of a property. And I don't mean that they don't respect the character, and I don't even mean that they don't respect the history. They're not thinking or worried about 5 years from now, because
they're not going to be there.
That's just so far beyond their need to comprehend, you know? And back in the day, when I was writing New Warriors 20, I could have told you what New Warriors 100 was going to be. You know, I had the book laid out to 100 issues. When I was writing Red Robin just 10 years ago, I had the book laid out through issue 75, and I got New 52 with issue 25. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I changed the way I think too. That I wasn't kidding when I said, if you guys don't want to pursue the juggernaut status quo a month after issue 5 comes out, that's fine with me. I don't care, you know. We all want you to continue the status quo we set up, because we're doing it because we think it's good. You know what I mean? We're not doing it because we think it sucks. But there's a lack of feeling that the continuity is as important as the generation I came in with. And we're already two generations cycled through creatively. There was a whole new generation of creative talent that came in the early aughts, and now there's a whole new generation of talent that's coming in the last 5 years. And that's very normal. That's very natural. It's 10 to 15 year cyclical arcs of creative generation.
And it just seemed to be quicker turnover as well now with the sort of, you know, the work for hire companies. That turnover of generations of creators seems to be a little bit quicker, from what I can tell, because, you know, the creators that I loved sort of growing up, you know, their sort of time of dominance could last 15, 20 years. Whereas now I see creators sort of coming in maybe 5 years and then disappearing, or maybe 10 years. But that longevity doesn't seem to be as evident, not so commonly evident anymore. And that's probably part of the reason. That sort of short.
It absolutely is. It is. And the other reason is that in the old days, everyone worked to try to get a job at Marvel or DC. And nowadays, everyone at Marvel and DC is not everyone. Most creators at Marvel or DC are working to try to build a name for themselves so that they can sell more copies of their independent book or their image book or whatever. And I get that too. I totally get it. You know, the sales being what they are right now, and page rates at Marvel and DC being what they are right now, I could sell a third of what a Marvel book might be and make five times more money. You know, if I did an image book that sold a third of what Juggernaut number one sold, I would make, considering my page rate and lack of royalties, I could make probably 20 times off of an image book that sold 20,000, 25,000 copies versus Juggernaut number one, which sold like 75,000 copies.
Yeah, there's a lot more people in the chain, isn't there, in the big companies?
Well, it's just the minute the sales dropped across the board in the industry and became the status quo, that meant that the royalties and incentives weren't there anymore. Mm. So you could make incentive money back in the day on Marvel on a book selling 45,000-50,000 copies, and you got a three-figure check for that. And if you sold 250,000 copies, you got a four-figure check, right? If you sold 700,000 copies, you were getting, you know, five-figure checks, right?
So massive incentive. Yeah.
That was the incentive. The incentive was to get to write, you know, three top 10 selling books like I did.
To be able to
make enough money that you're paying for your kids' college tuition and you don't even have kids yet. You know, that doesn't exist now. You're only going to get that kind of money in the comic industry right now if you're selling an image book that sells, you know, 25, 30, 40,000 copies. If you do that, the bank is there for you, you know?
Yeah.
And I totally get it. There's no judgment involved in what I'm saying this at all. It's just the reality of how things have evolved and changed, you know?
Yeah.
So if I'm writer X working on, you know, Venom, I have an incentive to make Venom really cool, and I have professional pride to make it really good, and I want it to be really, really entertaining. But my goal is to build as much of a reputation as I can for myself so that I can then draw you to my independent comic that's coming out from Image next year. You know what I mean? Because if I get 30% of you who is reading Venom, I'm making, you know, three to five times what I'm making at Marvel doing it, you know? Yeah.
And there we go. Again, another reason why there's this turnover, because, you know, once you've done your 5 years at Marvel and established yourself, if you've got the goods, you're going to move on. You're going to go and do something at Image or Dark Horse or whatever, where you can do your own thing. So it must be quite hard at Marvel now to attract, you know, the amount of talent that they used to, because of that temptation.
Well, I don't think it's hard for them to attract it. And I can't answer, because there's a world of difference between being on the inside on a daily basis and viewing it from the outside. And I know that because I've been both. I think it's still easy to attract talent. It's harder to keep it.
That's a better way of putting it.
If you become someone who's really good at selling books for them, chances are pretty good you're going to move to selling books for yourself.
Mm.
And then you got to replace them with someone new who may not be as good at selling books for you. And that's just the reality of the business. But look, there's also the truth that you can do a bunch of, you can use that, build your cred, do a bunch of Image books, but even that has often a diminishing returns. Even your third or fourth new series for Image may not sell as well as the first one you did right out of the shoot, leaving Marvel or DC. And then you got to go back to Marvel to rebuild your audience again, because at the end of the day, all sales being relatively equal, Marvel sales are still better. Not only that, your promotional draw is better.
I
get a lot more promotional draw in the comics industry for writing Juggernaut and now X-Men Legends than I do for Outrage, that I do for Webtoon, which is creator owned series. And I got more people reading Outrage than are reading Juggernaut, or probably will be reading X-Men Legends, but that doesn't matter because the industry is completely refuses to cover digital comics, you know, podcasters and the media, they completely ignore digital comics. So, I'm second season of Outrage just started a week ago, and there's 28 chapters that you can read for free on Webtoon. Right.
But that's on Webtoons. Okay, guys, you heard it here.
Getting the press and publicity mechanisms to pay attention to it is impossible. It's impossible. You know, so
it's an uphill struggle, isn't it?
It's such an interesting irony that the comic that has had more people read it than anything I've written since 1994 is the least known of anything that I've done in years. Look at that. Sounds good.
Yeah. And who's the artist on that?
Riley Brown is the artist. I want to get him on actually. He did Cable and Deadpool with me. Back in the day, that was his first assignment for Marvel back then. And we co-created this about 5 years ago, and I finally got off my lazy ass and started working on it, and we sold it to Webtoon. It's creator shared because they're paying us for the chapters that we do so that the art team can be paid. We own 80% of it, and Webtoon owns 20% of it, which is a fair deal in my mind, because Riley and the inker and the colorist and the letterer all need to get paid.
So
we get a chapter fee which is equitable to their Marvel rate. And then if we have extrapolation of it, if it goes to film or television or animation, then we're getting the bulk of that, and we have the control over that.
I've been checking out Webtoons actually, and there's a lot of stuff on it. Yeah, you just have to troll a bit because there's
almost like Netflix in a way. You gotta search, you know, search is sometimes challenging. Look, Shane, you gotta understand that the platform is almost geared for the primary audience, which is like 12 to 20 year old Asian girls. Okay. And since you are not as far as I can
tell. Last time I checked.
The 20-year-old Asian girl.
He is online on some sites.
Yeah.
He just doesn't tell anyone.
Yeah, well, just keep that to yourself, Ollie.
If it's possible, maybe Sam can put up a picture of Shane trolling on some of those sites. That would be greatly appreciated, Sam. Thank you.
Don't do it, Sam. We will have to wrap this up soon, actually, because I think some of us are ready for bed. But Webtoons, Mark Abnett has said, Webtoons is massive. Lore Olympus, one of the top three Webtoons books, is created by a Kiwi creator. Mark is a Kiwi, that's why he's saying that, who couldn't get work anywhere else, and it's going to be a Netflix series soon. So that's interesting, because you said it's like a Netflix for comics. But it seems that there might be this sort of funnel of creativity from Webtoons to Netflix. So
well, yeah, they in the last 6 to 8 months, actually, Netflix Webtoons set up a department here in the States, because it's a Korean company, so there's always issues between dealing with the LA office, having to then deal with the Korean office, having to have it come back to the LA office, then having it disseminated to us here on the East Coast. They have set up a department with three or four people in it, and their job is to basically develop Webtoon Studios and try to get more things happening for the properties. Now, Webtoon owns a lot of the properties. A lot of the stuff is created is work for hire. Some of it's creator owned. They're gonna smartly have a vested interest in developing and pushing the things they get a financial stake in quite a bit more, obviously, than something that they own wholly themselves. But they've already made several deals. They have some stuff in development for Crunchyroll and some other things like that. I think Outrage would make a really good television series, but I also think it would make a really good animated movie too. We have the rights to that, so I can and should be pushing that more through my agent. But I got to be honest with you, the book work and the book opportunities have taken so much precedent over my comic book opportunity, comic book work, that I've been really focusing on that, because my book is probably going to be on Netflix before Outrage is what it amounts to. So I mean, that's what I got to try to do.
If you concentrate on one thing at a time, you tend to do a better job, I find, as well.
I still juggle 6-7 things at once, because I feel, Shane, that 30 years of doing this, I have achieved a certain level of excellence of mediocrity, and I need to keep that going. So I will always be mediocre, but I will always be excellent in mediocrity. So I have that over all the other excellent writers out there.
I think that's the quote for this episode. Excellent, you know.
I am excellent in my mediocrity.
That's a good one. I like that.
There are a lot of people who are mediocre who are not excellent at it. Some of them are even mediocre at being mediocre. How bad is that? That's really depressing. I am excellent in my mediocrity. Yeah. And I do feel that way about myself as a writer. So, you know, my goal is to continue to give you that mediocre level of entertainment that I've been able to attain.
Is that a pull quote for the back of your novel? What? A pull quote for the back of your novel there. I aim to be mediocre.
You will be entertained by the excellence of this mediocrity.
Well, we've all certainly enjoyed your work.
Yes, really much.
And
I feel even during this entire broadcast, I have been excellent in my media. You are. So thank you for that.
You've made us look less mediocre by default.
That's it, yeah. We've tried our best at mediocrity, but, you know, we just couldn't match it.
You guys are above my level. You guys are above mediocre at what you do, and Sam's your ace in the hole, obviously.
Oh, yes.
He's the silent killer.
He's the master of mediocrity.
He is. He invented it, man. So we are going to wrap it up, because I think Sam has actually got to go to bed.
Yes, Sam.
You can't work at this level for long, you see. That's the thing.
It's exhausting.
Yeah. So we will wrap it up, and I'd like to say thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. What a great
time. Thank you, guys. It was a real pleasure. Yeah. It was a lot of fun.
And enjoy the rest of your day as ours comes to a slow end.
I got to get dinner started. I got to actually go downstairs and get dinner started.
Right. And then after that, after you've done coffee, you do dinner, and then it's gin. Whiskey?
It might be. No, I had a bourbon yesterday. When I finished the book manuscript draft yesterday, I had a bourbon. It's the first
nice.
Time in a month. So I don't know if I can have two in a row. I might die. So tonight may just be an episode of The Crown.
Another mediocre drinker.
I can't drink that much anymore. I'm just too old. I just fall apart.
One last comment from Chris. He said, hope to see you in the UK. Well, we do.
Anytime a London convention or a UK, I've gone to Edinburgh and that's it. I went to Edinburgh for one convention. UK does not like me. But I thought it was because I was Argentinian. I didn't know for sure. But UK never invites me to a convention.
But we've talked about you coming to ICE, and it just hasn't worked out for one reason or another. But we hopefully will sort that out in the near future once we can do our conventions again.
That would be fun. I hope we do conventions soon. I hope this vaccine actually works and people actually get it.
Yes, let's hope so. And so we'll hopefully see you in the future. So thanks
again. People need to get it first, though, guys, okay? Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's give the vaccine to all the rich white people first. Because they need it in order to keep the world going for the
rest. They're the key workers.
We'll be in line. The mediocre people will be in line after the wonderful rich white people.
I'm sure I'm last in the queue, you know, bald and fat. Where's that in the queue, you know?
I've been watching The Crown right now, season 4, and I'm just picturing like Elizabeth and Charles elbowing each other to be first in line to get the vaccine because they think they deserve it somehow because their excellent lives have earned that vaccine first.
Does it work on lizards?
Oh, Lolly with the good line.
We're on a roll now. It's a shame.
Yeah, we are. All right, guys. I appreciate it. Sorry if you're dragging this out.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Good night and take care. Rob VT.
Take care. Thanks, everyone who was listening and chatting on the side.
So thank you to everybody who tuned in for that one. It was good fun. Thank you to Fabian, of course, for being our guest. Thank you for Ollie for being my co-host. The Icecast will return in just a couple of short weeks. So until then, all the best for 2021 to each and every one of you.